I think it's apropos. I am a big book enthusiast. I am not a guru. I am not a professional. I am not a, what's the word? Expert. But I grew up with one of these ideas, which was, I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt. So I am fully convicted only because of what I have experienced through Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just wanted to get that out there. My name is Meredith McCabe, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 30th, 1998. My home group is, it's in the book. We meet at the 8111 Club on Saturday mornings and Sunday nights. I have a sponsor, my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor others, and I just love just being a link in the chain of a fellowship that has given me everything worthwhile in my life. So, let's see. The first time I drank, I was 10. It was Thanksgiving, and we had champagne in cute little glasses. My grandmother said, oh, what can that hurt? And I had five brothers and sisters, well, four at the time. One was going to come later. And I got to drink this, like, thimbleful of champagne, and it made me all tingly, and I remember my ears getting red, and this heat going through me, and I loved it, and I was delighted that two of my brothers hated it, and I got to drink theirs. And I remember feeling really giggly, and I remember wearing a dress with a crinoline under it, so that'll tell you how old I am. If you don't know what it is, you can Google it. But I found myself doing somersaults for our company, and I played piano for Aunt Ginger, and I hate playing the piano, and then I remember I suddenly needed a nap, and I woke up with a big headache from the nap. But I remember going back to school and telling my friends, oh my gosh, our Thanksgiving was great. I got to drink champagne, and I can't wait till Christmas because we drink champagne at Christmas too. Now, I remember wanting a Snuggle Bun doll that Christmas and go-go boots. So I was going off in different directions as it was, and now we're going to add the champagne. Now, that's the only time I drank until I was 14. By the time I was 14, my family had been uprooted from the suburbs of New York City. We moved to the Adirondacks, where my dad thought it would be a good environment for a bunch of kids to grow up. My mom, who had believed in God first and husband second, was disillusioned quickly because my father left, and there we were with the six of us in this small town where if you didn't have one of four last names, you did not fit in. And I already had feelings of insecurity, and I'd already felt like I didn't fit in, and that just magnified it. And I don't know where that came from, because we all got along really well in my family. I was always very popular, but I was that kind of girl that if 22 out of the class liked me and the 23rd person didn't, I was going after that 23rd person to get them to like me. And I was obsessed with that rather than just being one and being satisfied with what I had. I'm in a small town. Okay, this is how small it is. 23 in my graduating class, 16 women, 7 guys. My high school boyfriend was really cute, but he was also mean as hell, but I didn't care because I was going to hang on to him with tooth and nail. And there were things like I was captain of the cheerleading squad, and I couldn't even do a flip. I was president of student council, but it's because there was so much apathy, I ran unopposed. I was valedictorian because the smartest guy in the class graduated a year early, you know. But when I went to college, I told the people all about these great things that I was, because on the inside, I felt like I was not worth anything. And I don't know where that comes from, but I just didn't feel like I was worth anything. And the book talks about, you know, Bill in his expanded story talks about that, how he felt like so little on the inside. And you hear in here, we have big egos with inferiority complexes. And that was me all over the place. And how that manifested was showing off. I would get attention if I was funny or entertaining. And that seemed to come easily to me, and even more easily once I had a few, I started out with Boone's Farm. And once I had half the quart of that, I was off and running. And then when that was no fun anymore, I went to Whiskey Sours. And I was one of those people that I was busy being on Honor Society, and on weekends you'd find me in the back of some car, you know. That set up my life for me very early. I would spend the whole week trying to get over the nightmare I created for myself on the weekends. and it was a really small town. So I had a bad reputation very early, but I was also a high achiever. So people would say things like, oh, she's from a broken home, or, you know, her mother. So, you know, so people try to, you know, excuse it, but it didn't change how it made me feel. And I wanted to live differently, but I couldn't. And I didn't know that what I lacked was power. And the God of my understanding, my mom was raised Catholic, but when Dad left, she was like, this stinks, you know, where's God? But I was introduced to certain rituals that I like, and I'm like what it says in on a Starry Night, you know, you find you're awed by, every now and then you feel like you sense there must be a God that created all this, but you don't really feel it. You know, I just wanted to really feel, I needed to be convinced. And the book talks about how that feeling is fleeting and soon lost. And so, as much as I wanted to want to believe, I didn't feel like there was anything helping me in my life. And I came up with this sort of Santa Claus God. You know, if you love me, you wouldn't let this happen. If you love me, you wouldn't let that happen. I really didn't understand the nature of God or what my part in the relationship was. So I had this really bad reputation. You know, the book talks about the real alcoholic who does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. I've definitely done some absurd things. I remember in college, I was the one who in my freshman year said I would never stand in front of the entire school and flash myself. And then 4 years later, there I was. And the tragic thing was, it was a women's college. What was the point, you know? I had started out as a nursing major. I was pretty smart, but I changed my major to theater and English. And that was a really good idea. Self-initiated major. Me in control of my future. And when I graduated, I went back and worked a third shift at a diner in the town where I graduated as a valetorian, and I was called like things like my little tomato by the truckers. It was really special. I then got a big job with the Olympic Committee. I was in the right place at the right time because I grew up in that area, and I made a host of fair weather friends. I enjoyed great drink and great food and great times, but then I kind of stayed around. And my years in that tourist town, I worked my way down from the exclusive fancy resort to the local gin mill where my nickname was Nightmare. The owner of the bar was a woman. She was raised over a bar. Her mom was crazy. Her entire family was alcoholic. And she owned this bar, and we were like gasoline and water. We did not mix. And even though I worked for her. And we were very careful not to be on a tear at the same time because it was pretty ugly. But usually once a year for the bar fly open, where we were dedicated to coming in dead last, we would go out and get drunk afterwards. And in that town, you go around the lake to the bars. We call it going ATL. And now I'm in ATL, Georgia, but we call it going ATL. And she and I were out getting drunk together. And I was the kind of drinker that, because of all this resentment and self-loathing and life has really screwed me, once I drank, I would kind of turn the corner. And Madeline, that was my boss, she was known to do that too. And when we got really drunk, our nicknames, well, one of the bartenders from one place called the next bar and said, they just left here, they're on the way, Nightmare and Cujo are coming, lock the door. So I'm Nightmare and she's Cujo. So you can just imagine how unlovely we were. And then we go back to the bar that she owns, and she'd come in really drunk, and she'd find some poor soul just sitting there sucking on his Budweiser, and she'd go, dance with me, you know, and there's not even a band, you know, and it's just a bass player or whatever, you know, and I thought to myself, you know, I would have flashes of, if I don't get out of this town, I'm going to end up like that. I mean, every single female bartender in that town, you know, back then, the bartenders and drug dealers were my heroes. And I thought, if I go that way, I'm going to be gravelly voiced and bitter like them. And I just needed to get out. And my sister lived in Georgia, so I thought I'll just go down there and visit her. So once a year, I'd come to Jasper, Georgia, and I wouldn't smoke, and I wouldn't drink, and I'd jog, and I'd listen to all the bugs. I loved all the bugs at night. It was just awesome. And I thought, well, if I can do this for a week, clearly my problem is living in Lake Placid, so I just need to move to Georgia. Besides, the head of the BCI called my mom and said, they're looking at your daughter. You might want to tell her to cool it. Because I had gotten involved in some outside issues that would enable me to drink longer. And so I was well known for that, too. I had a great reputation. So I decided to move to Georgia, and when I got here, it didn't take me too long to find the local bar and the townhouse right near the bar, so I could walk home from the bar. But of course, I never walked. I always drove. I was a very good drunk driver. I never got a DUI. I probably qualified for, you know, 100,000. And I took up residence in this bar where I couldn't not go. I mean, I was, at this point, I'd worked my way up. I got a job as a waitress. I got to be a trainer and then a manager. And then I was general manager of a good restaurant in town. And I let them know, this was back before cell phones, I don't even think I had a pager, but it would have been about that time, and I left my phone number for the bar on the Rolodex. If I'm not here, I'm at Whiskers. If you have an emergency, call me there. And they never called me there unless it really was an emergency, and they all drank at a different bar, so there was never any worlds colliding. The only way they knew I was really out of control was that I was always pretty stinky. I dressed up pretty well, but I reeked. And I ruled by fear and intimidation. I was, you know, you never knew how I was going to treat you because my best defense is an offense, and it's not pretty. So I kept people at arm's length like that. That went on. You know, Bill's story talks about the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, and mind endured this agony for 2 years. And mine was more like, well, I suspect that I was alcoholic when I had my first blackout when I was 16. And by the time I'm 22, I can't even stay in the dorm for the whole week. By Wednesday night, I just have to go out. And certainly by the time I was living in Lake Placid, I knew I was alcoholic. And then when I moved to Georgia, you know, the book talks about, this is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. It's this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And I began to have wish when I was 16 and my reputation was shot, but it wasn't enough to hold me in check. And I was always, you know, high strung and full of anxiety. And when I drank, it was better. And I just thought I could find a way to control it. Sort of like in Bill, where he said, even though he was having, things got worse, he was drinking 2 bottles of gin a day, he said, I still thought I could control it. You know, I mean, the delusion is just astounding. What happened to me was my cousin, who had been in therapy since she was like 9, sent me a pamphlet when she was 37 or 8, and it was the pamphlet from Alcoholics Anonymous, A Letter to a Woman Alcoholic. And at this time, I was living in my subterranean apartment in Dunwoody. I hadn't lived above ground for the past 6 years. I lived in the dark, and I was comfortable there. And she sent me this pamphlet, and I opened it up, and before I finished reading the first page, I was crying on my couch in my apartment because I knew it was me. So I embarked on my program, which was don't drink, go to work, rent movies from Blockbuster, go home, and mark it up the calendar because I'm so happy, joyous, and free, and I'm not drinking. And that lasted 23 days. And then, you know, you hear in the rooms, we chose to drink again. But Bill talks about the frightful day that came when he drank again. And for me, it was beyond frightful. It was demoralizing and pathetically sad because it was a Sunday night and I was driving from my work and I could not pull off that highway to that crappy little bar on a Sunday night and drink. And I was crying as I went in there. And there's nothing more depressing than a gin mill on a Sunday night. But I had to go because if the magic didn't happen Friday, it's going to happen Saturday night, and then Sunday's the last chance. And I was a bar drinker, and I drank alone, and I was a woman that drank alone, and I did all those things that women who drink alone a lot in bars do. And by the time I had made my first trek into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no self-respect. I was, like, spiritually dead inside. I felt useless. I didn't have a reason for living. I heard people say things like they lost their husbands and they lost their children, and I never had either, and it's because I was always too drunk to attract a husband, and I threw all that away. I'm grateful, though, because it would not have been pretty, you know, and I have found, as a result of what I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, a whole different reason for living, which satisfies all that. And I am the greatest aunt that ever lived, as Bernice would say, on both sides of the family. So, okay, so she sends me this pamphlet. I try to get sober on my own. That doesn't work. Then my friend gets court-ordered into AA, and I go with her just to check it out because I'm clearly not as sick as you people that need steps and sponsors. I mean, I still have really good crap. I got a house. I got a BMW. I got a big job. I got no friends and no self-respect, no boyfriend, but I got some crap. So I can't be as bad off as you. So I'm sitting in the meetings in the dark. And as soon as the meeting's over, I'm going to the bar and drinking Diet Coke, and I hate all that. And And I got 12-stepped in that bar. There was a woman who came up to me. There was a whole bunch of people sitting around talking and laughing. I didn't pay any attention to what they were drinking. But she came up to me and she says, "Man, you remind me of me." I said, "Really?" She goes, "Yeah." She goes, "I used to come in here and I'd sit and I'd have a few drinks and then I'd feel really good and then I'd be the life of the party and then I'd go home and I'd cry." I was like, "I don't even know her." And she said, "Maybe you recognize me. I used to sing with the band." I said, "Really? The same one that I've been flashing the last few years?" You know, it's funny, when my sponsor, when I finally got a sponsor, she said, "I want you to pray on your knees morning and night." And I didn't have a connection with God, and I didn't feel like I was worth it. And I felt awkward about praying on my knees. Not awkward taking my shirt off in that bar, but awkward in my room by myself. So anyway, she said, "I used to do that, but now I go to meetings, and will you come?" So I started going to the 10 o'clock meeting with her, and she was my first sponsor, and we didn't work steps or anything. She had a notebook in her trunk, and it was kind of torn up, and there was some pencil writing in it, and it was steps 4 through 7. I never did see the book 1 through 3, but I didn't stay, because I couldn't. It was not satisfying to me. I hadn't done any steps, and I wasn't about to, and I was restless, irritable, discontented. And even though in the meetings they say you chose to drink again, I got driven back into Alcoholics Anonymous 18 months later. I had, my bottom was sort of in three parts. I first became diagnosed with diabetes, and I couldn't understand why I was getting fatter and fatter. And I'm sick and tired of hearing about men coming in here. I'm 40 pounds underweight, and I came in here, you know, like this. But I was getting fatter and fatter and fatter, and suddenly I got diagnosed with diabetes, and I told my sister about it. But I was starting to lose weight because my sugar was so high. I was in that ketoacidosis, and I was just burning all this fat. And my sister said, "You got to get this fixed, you know, because you're going to die." And I said, "Can I wait till I reach my goal weight? Because it's really coming off now." And I went to the doctor, and he prescribed this medication that said you need to take this with every meal, and then there's a little thing about the little martini and the slash in it, and you can't drink when you're on this. And I felt like the blood was rushing out of my body, because I thought, how am I going to not drink? So I went into a new phase, binge drinking, where I would abstain, because I'm the general manager and I can write my own schedule, so my life is not unmanageable. And I can abstain, and everybody in my path is a victim of my restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness. And then I finally schedule myself 4 days off, and I drink until I can't stand it anymore, and then I go back to work. And that was my new routine. But now I have necessity, right? Now I've got diabetes. And not only that, I think about the fast forward. The vision for me was, I'm going to end up blind. I'm going to lose a limb or something, you know. And then I'm going to be sitting in that bar with these really thick glasses on and a wooden leg going, you know. And no one's going to. I mean, really, that's the first thing I thought. I'm going to, because I didn't, the thinking that I could stop drinking did not enter my mind. And then the next part of my bottom, the second part was, at this point, I've been promoted, because I'm somehow managing to not let the worlds collide, and I'm faking them all out, and now I am in charge of, I'm the talent manager for my company. My job is to go out there and find managers, hire managers, train managers, assess managers. And one of our biggest hubs is Myrtle Beach. And I was there, and I got very drunk, and I made a jerk of myself, April Fool's, and then got back to Atlanta, and my boss called 2 weeks later and said, and now he lives in Myrtle Beach, and he calls him Sunday morning, 11:30, and says, "We need to meet. Any time today would be good." I'm like, "Oh, that's okay. How about 11:30? And we met at one of the restaurants I worked at, and I walked up to him with a big handshake, and he said, "We have something very serious to discuss." And he recounted to me some of the things I did, and he could tell that I had a vague recollection of those events. And he said, "You've got to clean up this mess, and you've got to go to this general manager and say this." And he said, so he had me doing amends before I even had done step one. And he said, "And this can never happen again. You have to be professional, always professional." And I said, "I promise you'll never have to worry about this happening again." And as I said it, I knew I did not know how I was going to not do it again. I no longer could trust myself. I didn't know where I was going to wind up or with whom. But I said, "This will never happen again." And then the most wonderful thing happened. I met Mr. Wright in Whiskers, because that's where I met all my Mr. Wrights. And this was different, though, because he was my age. He'd never been married. We were both lying to our families about being in recovery. He liked to dance, but there was no band. And this one was pretty perfect, except that, well, he was gay. And I didn't know it. I mean, we had a family barbecue. Everybody met him. Mom said, why is he late? I said, he told me he's coloring his hair. He's going to be here soon. That didn't occur to me that maybe that was a little out of the ordinary. He weighed less than me, and I remember clearly having a standard to never outweigh my dates, and I broke that rule for him. But really, I thought we were getting married. Well, it turns out he had picked me as his beard because his sister was getting married and everybody was coming to town, and he wanted to make it look like everything was fine in his life, and he picked me to prove it. And I was like, I'm not doing in whiskers. So everything's going along great with Norman. That's why I named my bottom Norman, because that was really when things turned around. We dated for a few weeks, and then I went out with an old friend of mine, one of those friends with benefits people, and we went to the Page and Plant concert out at Lakewood, and I had a whole bunch of outside issues with me, and it was just a blast, and I ended up doing what I usually do. If I'm with a guy, a lot of stuff with me and, you know, out of my mind, and I woke up with severe guilt and remorse, not unlike many other Saturday mornings, and I sat there, what's going to happen now, what am I going to do now? And my biggest concern was, I've ruined this relationship with Norman. He was perfect. We're supposed to get married. If he finds out, it's over. So I thought to myself, what am I going to do? And I called that first sponsor, and I said, I need help. And I said, will you meet me for a meeting? She said, yes. And so I waited 3 days, and I went on a Tuesday night. And it was her. She was picking up her second-year candle. We had picked up candles at these meetings. Because I really wanted to save this relationship. I never saw Norman again. He disappeared. He never heard about my infidelity. But the wedding was over. My part was played. And I could never find the guy. And I told my son, Patty, I'm like, I'm trying to find Norman. And I said, and I know he's a student of medical science at Emory. She said, he works at the women's department in Wicked. My sister and I stalked him. We went to Richard's because I could not believe that. And I had to pretend I was looking for a cotton blanket. Because I really always did kind of want a cotton blanket. Down here, you don't need those wool ones. And he was folding towels. And I was just mortified. And he was avoiding me. So anyway, so that's how my God works. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous to save a relationship that doesn't even exist. I mean, that's just priceless. I also quit smoking for that guy. I mean, I quit smoking and drinking on the same day. And someone told me like 3 months into my sobriety, oh, you shouldn't do that. I said, well, you should have told me 3 months ago when I did it. I was just sick and tired and ready to be done. And so I started going back to meetings, and I wasn't, you know, I heard things like, you just come in here and you choose not to drink again. And I was thinking, I don't know about that. I'm thinking a lot about it. And I didn't know who was going to help me. I was one of those people that crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous so I could look down on you. Who's going to help me? Which one of you are going to help me? I'm different. And I heard things like, you know, DUIs, lost families, lost wives, and that just wasn't my story. But I didn't care about living. The last couple years of my life, every time I thought about something heinous that I did, whether it was a week ago or 25 years ago, flashing through my mind was a vision of me slitting my wrists over and over again. Or I could taste gunmetal in my mouth. There was a stone wall in this one town that had my name on it. I don't know how many times I drove, and I thought, can I just drive into this wall? And so when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard this woman talk, and she said that we have a mental illness that is primarily mental, and that we can't control our thoughts, and that our mental illness is characterized by disproportionate thinking and the inability to think straight, I was like, well, maybe this thing up here has to do with alcoholism. I really just thought it was a drinking problem. But I couldn't trust myself anymore, and I wanted to be dead. But I didn't want to be dead. And those unwelcome thoughts came. So when she introduced me to this book and told me, you have an allergy to alcohol, so once you start, you can't stop. That I got, and I got used to that. But when it was explained that I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, unless I get that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once, I understood that too. And it said, I am doomed to repeat. Unless I experience an entire second change. She said, it's something you have to live through. It's not something you've been lectured through or talked at through or counseled through. I have to live through a process that's going to change me. So in a page in the doctor's opinion, this phrase is used 3 times. Psychic change. It means of the mind and the soul. That's pretty total. Heck, in the first pages of the book, it says we've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I'm sick mentally and physically, and that's just for starters. But in a way, that was very, that was a relief to me. So I thought, and my sponsor said, you've got to diagnose yourself according to what this book says. So I asked her to be my sponsor, right? I hear her share, and she always shares too long, and lights are coming out of her eyes when she shares, and then she talks about this book, and she always sits in the front, and she's got five or six people with her with the book, looks like a goose with a bunch of chicklings behind her, and I would get up nervous, I gotta ask her, and then I would chicken out. Happened 3 times. And I didn't see her for weeks at a time in between, and I'd stalk her, I'm like, where's that woman with the silver hair? I gotta find her! So I finally got the nerve to ask her to be my sponsor. And I went up to her after the meeting, and I said, will you be my temporary sponsor? And she said, do you want temporary sobriety? I'm like, well, no, can I change? I didn't know I was supposed to ask that question. And then she said, have you ever been sober before or worked the steps? I said, no, I had about 90 days once, and I chose to drink again. She said, oh, you chose to drink again? Really? You had never worked with a sponsor, you never took the steps, and you never had a psychic change, and you chose, right? And I was thinking, can I change my answer? Because I remember those frightful days when I said I wasn't going to drink, and I drank again, and there was no choice in that. I felt like I was possessed. The book says we're in the grip of a progressive illness, and that's how I felt. And I hated it. So she was pretty smart, you know. So she said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to start reading the book, highlight what you identify with. I want you to call me at a certain time. What time can you call me every day at the same time? Help me agree with that, because that's the last choice you're going to make for a while. Oh, okay. So, and then she goes, I want you to start reading and bring your book to the meetings. And when they read how it works, read from your book, sit in the front row. Don't share. You have nothing to offer. I'll never forget that woman's meeting where they were complaining about the sponsors. And my sponsor wasn't there. And I wanted so much to complain about my sponsor, but she doesn't let me share, so I couldn't. I did share, and then it got back to her. And I'm like, how'd you find out? She goes, there's a narc in every crowd. And it's true. Remember when you're sitting in that bar, you're like, that's a narc, you know? So anyway, she got me into this program of action, and I am very grateful. To me, surrender was key, and it didn't happen until I had run out of options. Because until I surrender, they say, you've got to do the work. There is no work if you surrender. There's none. You just got to decide and then do it. And so I was calling at a certain time. I was meeting her for certain meetings. All things are going great. And I really wasn't accepting. And I felt like I was doing something about it. But I also felt like I was in the weeds, man. I carried back then my phone didn't have an alarm on it. I carried a little travel clock. I set it. And my sister and I went out. She said, don't forget to call your sponsor. You know, I was like, gosh. And then what page am I on? And I really liked it for like 2 weeks. And I was like, sick of it. And there was supposed to be a meeting at Charter, and I was supposed to go to that meeting at Charter, and I said, my car's in the shop, I can't go to Charter. She said, well, lucky for you, you have 3 hours to get a bus over there. And I'm like, the car is coming out of the shop. And I just knew, for some reason, I couldn't fool her. And I liked that because I didn't have a lot of respect for the people that bought all my gazillion excuses. I was like, you people are sorry. You don't know that I'm putting it over on you. And this woman, you know, a friend of mine said, you can't game a gamer. And that's how it was with her. But she had this power. I didn't know I lacked power, but she had something I liked. And I remember I kept thinking, if I could have part of what she has, it wouldn't be so sucky. I mean, I was just shooting for less sucky. You know, just bring it up to that. And things started to get better. But then she forced me to fellowship, too. You know, we're all going to go to Dahlonega, and we're going to go to that big restaurant and eat together. I'm like, those girls hate me. Your other sponsors hate me. And it's because I was an AA brown nose. My sponsor would, like, lead into us if we were, like, not in the meeting on time or not reading our book. I'm like, she is not going to yell at me in that lobby. I am going to do everything she says. And the other girls hated me for that. So, but we go up there, it's a while ago, and one of the girls she sponsors says, we went to this gift store and there were whips for sale. And she goes, and she'd been sponsored by this woman for 5 years. I'd been sponsored for 5 minutes. And she goes, let's get this for Liz, this whip. And I said, I'm not buying that for her. I said, but Karen never had any money. I said, I'll tell you what, I buy, you give it to her. And like, deal, you know. So by, at that point on, we had a common peril that we shared and we sort of bonded through that. My sponsor took me through this book. You know, she also told me I had to read on my own. And as I read, I saw things that I started to believe in. She said it's like a recipe. If you follow this, if you do what I did, you'll get what I got. If you follow the recipe, you'll get the results. And I was desperate enough to try this. I mean, I thought I could always at least, you know, I could do something different later if I wanted. So, and I like things like vital to permanent recovery is strenuous work when alcoholic with another. I know there's some recovering alcoholics out there, but if I hear someone with 15 years say they're a recovering alcoholic, I'm like, if I have the flu for 15 years, I'm killing myself. So I like what it says in here, we recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. She would give this great analogy. Okay, life is a NASCAR race. Everybody's got their own car. You go into a spin that is alcoholism. You take actions to come out of the spin. Then you are recovered and you're back in the race. But you have to maintain those actions to keep you out of the spin. Love that. Love that. So I like it. So, okay, so vital to permanent recovery. So I'm getting an idea of what's going to happen here. And then this altruistic movement, my life depends on my constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. And I learned that if I complain a little bit too much about my life, I'm cleaning her bathroom. So I am not doing that either. All right? So, and I'm not supposed to share. And how it works is if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. One day she says to me, I want you at my house tomorrow morning at 8:30. Bring your book and bring enough food for the whole day because I know you're diabetic and I don't want you passing out on me. I'm like, that's just very sweet. I said, but I don't know where you live. She said, call me in the morning. I'll give you directions. And I'm thinking, oh, I wonder what else to get off so I could call her and get there on time. It was just brutal. And so, but I get over there, and she's in her kitchen, and she's pregnant, and pretty pregnant, and but she says, do you know why you're here today? And I said, no, she goes, we're going to work the steps. So I'm like, all of them? She said, have nothing, Bill and Billy. So I'm like, great. But I'd already worked 1, 2, and 3 by the actions I took. It's a program of action. I remember asking her, do you want me to write out step 1? She goes, sure. You can write, make a whole big list of what you're powerless over, and when you're done, I'll know that you know how to write. So I had to show her that I believed my life was powerless, and I did that by following direction by someone who had power, which was great because later on, having had a spiritual awakening of these, in, you know, through these steps, I'm going to be reliant upon a God that I rarely connect, you know, that I'm not connected as I'd like to be. I'm not getting, you know, I'm not hearing his voice. You know, I don't see him at the kitchen table. But I have to come to believe that he's there for me. And the only way I can transition that belief is to put faith in something besides me to begin with. It's a practice of a discipline. So anyway, so one is a, you know, one is a prayer. We write it out. We burn it. Two, then we get down for step 3 and she is kneeling and I'm kneeling and she is hooked up. You can tell she is hooked up to God and I am faking every bit of it. But the book says, this is a vital and crucial step. It really usually has very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by an effort to face and be rid of those things that are ourselves that are blocking us. And right there, that's, oh my gosh, that's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. At least 4, 5, 6, 7. So I realized, and I've been reading up to page 57 over and over again for her. What page are you on? 57. Start again. You need me to read 57. Start again. But at the end of the agnostics, it says, the God is within. And in the last analysis, it's only there that he may be found. I was looking for God along the river, in the mountains, in the sky, in churches. She said, the book teaches us that if we dig through and we do the spiritual surgery, we get the garbage out of the way that obscures the God within. And the agnostic says, you got to make an assumption as a starting point to believe a theory. For agnostics, the assumption is there is a God within that can be personal to you. For the atheist, it is there's a power greater than you. And in order to proceed, you have to accept that assumption. And I like how they use that example of electricity, you know, ohms, watts. I don't know how electricity works, but that hairdryer better be working when I turn it on in the morning. I don't question electricity, but I use it. So I take these steps, and I do my 4-step, and she's snoozing on the couch, watching lost episodes of Bonanza, and I am on the patio, blowing my nose and crying my eyes out. The skeletons were out of my closet, and they were dancing. And it was not good. Which is why I am so glad. In my lineage, we never let the sun set on a written 4-step. And the sponsor stays with you till it's done. And then we do 5. She shares her 5th step. I find out she's pretty messed up too. That's great. Then I can tell her my junk. And then we make the list, you know, the inventory. And amends list. And it's great because the amends list, it says we made it when we took inventory. I wondered what all those notes were she was taking. She was making my amends list. When I was done with 5, my list was done. Sweet, because I didn't have to sit around and say, oh, I don't have it done yet. I said, you got it done. And I started with the easiest one first, my sister. You know, she wanted nothing but for me to be sober. And I said, I have to make an appointment with you. I have to do my ninth step. And she said, can't we just say you're forgiven? I said, no, I got to do this. And it gave me a track record. You know, step nine was where the most amazing growth in relationship with God came, because there was more fear in that step than anything else. And by praying, talking to my sponsor, doing the reading, and then taking the action and just letting it rip and letting it come out okay on the other side, that's where I realized God's with me. You know, I wasn't smoked ashes. And that spiritual surgery gave me that do-over that I wanted, I don't know how many Mondays. So that was great. And I learned, too, about this, you know, this process. I was taught, as I went through the amends, that some of them were scary. Some of them, you know, people don't, I don't ask for forgiveness. I just say I was wrong, and I want to do it differently from now on. Living amends, I went really drunk to the dentist one time, oral surgery, serious oral surgery. And he finally said, how much did you drink last night? And it was just awful. So now I make appointments with the doctor. I take the earliest one I can get, and I don't go drunk. And they don't know how lucky they are, you know. So there's things like that. I remember being a few years sober. And you know, my sponsor said, you don't have to worry about things you miss. If things don't come up on that first four step, don't worry. You've got step 10 to catch it. And I remember, because step 10 is also written. I was taught inventory is written. I've never taken inventory in any bar I've worked and just kept it in my head. I had to write it down. So I did a 10-step inventory nightly for almost the first 3 years of my sobriety. And I do it every now and then, but I do it after the wheels start falling off. 10 years sober, I was so wrapped up in fear, and my job had become so important that I found myself lying and hiding and not staying close to God and not doing my inventory, and I was really sick. And I had just told my story at the Alpharetta barbecue, and I was really sick. And I had to get outside help. I'm so glad Alcoholics Anonymous says we don't have a monopoly on your therapy. And I found a guy who was told to me was like an angel on earth. Only I would take a year to go see an angel on earth. I mean, really, why wouldn't I have rushed? But it helped me get better. And what I've learned is that the fear is really just a boogeyman. And that with God, things will get better. And I didn't like the way it made me act. And I learned, too, that I have to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to work with newcomers. They keep me accountable. My sponsor told me after I took these steps that I had to start sharing at every meeting. First, I can't say a word. And now I've got to sit in the front row and share at every meeting. And I don't know what I'm going to say. So thank God I did go to Peachburg for 2 years. Because in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And it didn't matter what I was saying, as long as I could mutter a few things about sobriety and sponsorship. And it gave me a chance to learn how to carry this message. And I was taught selfless regard for others, selfless regard for others. The clubhouse that I got sober at was known as a meat market, and that was not my experience. Nobody came near me for the first 2 years. I would come in there with my big book and a few sponsees and sit in the front row, and they're like, Nazi, you know. And I remember having to explain myself, because this was before Big Book was really in vogue, you know, and they would say things like, so it's a Big Book meeting? No. Why do you have your book? Sponsors told me I'm bringing it. And to this day, I still do those things, because those are the things that, they're my routine. I had a routine when I drank. Here comes Friday. Okay, got to make sure I have the money for the liquor store. Got to call the dealer. Got to call the backup dealer. You know, got to get ready. Got to figure out where Jack's drinking so I can stalk him. You know, had to have a plan. So, you know, right in the middle of the word spiritual is ritual. And I learned as my sponsor taught me these spiritual acts like making my bed and admitting my wrongs and trying to do things better the next time. My self-esteem raised and my sense of purpose raised and my happiness grew. And, you know, I was talking to someone recently who said, what do you want? What do you want? Because I remember when I got my third-year chip, I remember standing up there going, it's really great, I love sobriety, there's a few things I still want, but it's all good, thanks very much. And, you know, about a year, you come in here and you get all this stuff, you know, and for me, I had all that stuff, and the book says we lose everything worthwhile in life. So even though I had all this stuff, I had nothing worthwhile. And I've lost a lot in sobriety. And I know now, when I look at my life from God's perspective, he's more interested in my character than my comfort. And he knows that's what's going to make me happier. And by looking at my life through God's eyes, every person that's been in my path has been there for a reason. My mom, I was not very kind to for a long time. And she had emphysema. And when I lost my big job, I was unemployed for a long time. And I got very close to someone who struggled with sobriety in and out, but was always faithful. And we helped each other a lot. So I have my mom and this very dear friend of mine. And when I would come home from traveling, my very busy, important regional manager job, I would go to my mother's on Saturdays. She lived in Jasper, and I would spend the day with her. And she was so appreciative, and we were very much alike. She was alcoholic, too, and our souls were so similar. And I just knew I wanted to do the right thing by her. And after a while, I started spending the night, because what's more important than that? And I'll never forget, she said one day, she goes, always marked on her calendar, Meredith in Cincinnati, Meredith in Boca, Meredith in Pittsburgh. I was traveling a lot for this company that I got the job with after my day job. And she would always write on her calendar, and she said, you know, you've come and spent the night 9 times in the last 6 months. It was so important to her, and I was such a brat, and I'm sarcastic, and you know, sarcasm is not kind. I don't know why I thought that was funny. I thought it was being funny. Sarcasm is not kind. Well, when she suddenly got quite sicker, which was great, because emphysema sucks, and she had a mini stroke, and she sort of slipped away, so my sister and I were able to be with her and administer morphine and play the music she liked and hold her feet and sing and pray, and it was 4 days, and it was priceless. And I realized after she died how much she had given to me in those times that I went to give to her. And then 3 weeks later to the day, my other friend died suddenly. And then a week later, my cat died. And then 2 weeks after that, I lost my job. And, you know, if I hadn't gotten sober and hadn't gotten to learn about this God of my understanding, you know, I started seeking the God of my understanding in new ways. One day it crossed my mind, what do you think about me? And I knew that it was God was saying, you know, my own inadequate perception was good enough for the beginning of my sobriety, but I need a God that's bigger than me, so I can't make him up in my head. So I started seeking. I started with, what do I really believe? And as my brother-in-law said, I believe the story. And I did too. So I sought that God. And I sought the literature that led me to that God. And I love that because, you know, in here, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. Another one of my spiritual heroes named Paul said, I've learned to be content in all situations. And that's what I've learned by developing a relationship with the God of my understanding. And there's nothing on this planet that I can't get if I just do what he asked me, which is step 3. He provides what I need if I stay close to him and perform his work well. And I stay close to him by keeping my soul clear of resentment and fear and dishonesty and self-centeredness. The 10th step says continue to watch for this. It doesn't say it's going to go away forever. So I have to continue to mind this if I want to keep it. And as I do, I'm happier. Even in those times, you know, if I hadn't got sober, I would have shaken my fist at the sky. And instead, I was so grateful for God and knowing where my mom and my loved ones were. And for them giving me what they gave me. And my mom's service, everybody talked about her kindness. And that was God saying, you know, you got to work on that a little bit, Meredith. My sponsees tell me that too. You know, you could have said that a little nicer. Just because I was sponsored by a fascist doesn't mean I have to be, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me every single thing that's good in my life. And I know that if I'm not continually working this program, which is foolproof, it's the recipe, that I can get off track. But when I'm on track, I have a sane and happy and useful life. And I don't suffer from the if-onlys anymore. If only this, if only that. My jobs have gone like right down the tubes. I mean, I used to have this really great big job, then I had a sort of little bigger job, and then I got to work at Aaron Sales and Lease, where I ruined my wrist, and boy, that's heavy furniture. And now I'm a warehouse manager. I got to change for this tonight in the warehouse. But I'm free in the evenings. I'm free on the weekends. I can be there for my family. I can be there for Alcoholics Anonymous, who's given me everything. And I have a great time doing it. I mean, I still deal with the problems, just like we all do, but I don't have to respond to them the same way I always did. And I remember that if I'm not the problem, there's no solution. I like to give the big book the last word. This comes from page 130 in The Family Afterward. Those of us who have spent much time in the world of spiritual make-believe have eventually seen the childishness of it. This dream world has been replaced by a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. We have come to believe He would like us to keep our heads in the clouds with Him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Meredith. That was awesome. Just awesome.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Take me where